G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Today's guest is the 28th Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott. I wanted to have an uncomfortable conversation with Mr. Abbott about largely three things. Firstly, the black armband view of Australian history. This is the sort of slang that we use to connote a worldview, which is that Australian history is fundamentally a story of imperial conquest and genocide against Indigenous people, and that we should sort of be permanently guilty for that. That's a worldview that Tony Abbott very much opposed when he was Prime Minister. He's a cultural conservative, he's a deeply Christian person, and he's on the centre-right of government. Secondly, I wanted to talk about climate change and the carbon tax. The centre-right party before Tony Abbott led it was led by a more moderate and pro-climate action parliamentarian named Malcolm Turnbull. And both the centre-right and centre-left parties in Australia in the 2000s supported an emissions trading scheme, largely as a result of the Conservative Party's support for an emissions trading scheme. Malcolm Turnbull was rolled as the leader. Tony Abbott was installed, saying, never ever will there be an emissions trading scheme or a carbon tax. Now, before Tony Abbott became Prime Minister, his predecessor from the other party, the centre-left party, did introduce a carbon tax, which was going to transition into an emissions trading scheme. And Tony Abbott ran on the platform of abolishing the tax, and Australia actually became the first country in the world to introduce a tax on carbon and then repeal a tax on carbon, and we've been living with the consequences ever since. Thirdly, I wanted to have an uncomfortable conversation about turning back the boats and illegal immigration and multiculturalism in Australia. Perhaps Tony Abbott's signal achievement as Prime Minister, what he is most renowned for and despised by some quarters of the country, is introducing a harsher policy towards boat arrivals, essentially finding boats that were belonged to people smugglers bringing migrants to Australia, sending out the Navy, and when the people smugglers would scuttle the boats, literally giving them an inflatable raft and then pushing them towards Indonesia. It's been a successful policy on the basis of the metrics of boat arrivals, but one that many people regard as being cruel and in contravention of international law. So Tony Abbott's new book gave me an opportunity to sit down with him. It's a book about Australian history. It's actually a really interesting book if you want to understand what made the country that we know and love today. It's called Australia, A History. Tony, just for a bit of background, was a Rhodes Scholar. He went to the University of Oxford, where he did his Master of Arts in Politics and Philosophy. He then trained to be a Jesuit priest. I wasn't kidding about his being a man of faith, and then served as he became a journalist briefly after he did not become a priest, and then he became press secretary to the opposition leader, John Hewson, and he became the leader of the Liberal Party in 2009 and the Prime Minister of Australia from 2013 to 2015. I hope you enjoy, as much as I did, the one and only Tony Abbott. This is fascinating. I respect this book a lot, actually, because if someone had told me that Tony Abbott had written a book about Australia, then I think many lefties would assume that it's going to be an apologia for all things Australia and a whitewashing of Australia's treatment of Indigenous people. But it's not. It's a really balanced and kind of rich explanation of a history that a lot of Australians don't know. What's the main fire in your belly for having written it?
Well, Josh, I always thought that at some point after leaving Parliament, I should write a book, but I didn't want to write memoirs, which is what your average politician does. And eventually I decided that rather than do the story of me, I should do the story of us. Now, I'm an enthusiast for Australia. I think there's more to be proud of than ashamed of in our history, but you can't tell the story without looking at the embarrassing, even shameful aspects too. So that's what I've tried to do with this, to tell our story as best I can, as objectively as I can. But I suppose at least from a glass half full rather than a glass half empty perspective, because I do think that particularly over the last generation, in correcting what Blaney called the old three cheers view, we have gone too far towards what he calls the black armband view. Now, again, there are shameful chapters in our history, and there's absolutely no doubt that the pastoral expansion caused mayhem for Aboriginal people. The frontier was a bloody and brutal place for everyone, but it was particularly bloody and brutal for Aboriginal people. But that's by no means the whole story of Australia. If you look at the whole story from the most unpromising beginning on the shores of Sydney Harbour in January 1788, within 100 years, the colonies had the world's highest standard of living, even higher than America. But more than that, we were a democratic laboratory of extraordinary freedom. I mean, in the 1890s, in the Australian colonies, both women and people of all races could vote, and in at least one of them, run for office. Now, nowhere else in the world at that time was that true. So while not shrinking from the downsides, I think we should also appreciate the upsides of our story.
Yeah, I mean, you even make the point, which I didn't know, which is shameful that I wouldn't have known, that in New South Wales, as a colony, Indigenous Australians, Indigenous males, had the vote in the 1850s
exactly
when
right.
slavery still existed in the United States. A lot of Australians believe that Indigenous people didn't get the vote anywhere in the country until the referendum in the 1960s.
I know. And I guess for all sorts of reasons, we have been forgetful, even amnesiac about our history. Partly, I think it's because we don't have a civil war or a war of independence. But again, that's actually vastly to our credit as a people. I mean, the Australian Commonwealth was not produced by war, by revolution, by conquest. It was the result of negotiation between a group of politicians who didn't agree on lots of things, except the fact that it would be desirable for the six colonies to federate into one Commonwealth. And over a period of a decade, through discussion, through compromise, and ultimately through a vote of the people, they did it. And so almost alone of the nations, we've got this inherently democratic, demotic, kind of sweet reason approach to things. Now, I think the challenge for contemporary Australia is to build on all of that. And I think the problem that we face is that our forebears thought big. Henry Parkes liked to tell people in his day, the 1880s and 1890s, that Australia then was in the same position that the United States had been in 100 years earlier, implying that we in the 21st century could be everything that America was at the end of the 19th century. Now, obviously, America has different geography. It's somewhat geographically differently placed to us. But I do think that we should set no limits on what we can achieve. If we feel good about ourselves as a nation, we're more likely to achieve great things.
So one of the other things about in terms of Australia's democracy in the early days that I hadn't realised was that although New Zealand was the first jurisdiction to give women the vote, Australia actually passed female suffrage legally before New Zealand did and was the first place in the world
where it actually happened.
So the New Zealanders just sort of pipped us to the post there, but we did it first.
Yeah.
So between Indigenous suffrage in the 1850s in New South Wales, the first place to pass female suffrage, and then another thing that you note that I think a lot of people wouldn't be aware of is that white people were hanged in the 1800s for killing Indigenous Australians. You know, although the frontier was brutal and bloody, it's not like we were living in a situation where there was complete and total impunity and an understood condition of genocide the way that a lot of people think it was today. I mean, do you want to tell the story of Plunkett and the big trial over Mile Creek?
Yeah. Well, I should stress, Josh, that there was only one Mile Creek. Mile Creek wasn't the only massacre, but the Mile Creek aftermath was pretty much unique in terms of the response. But the mere fact that white men were hanged for the murder of black people in the 1830s, there's no other settler society where this would have happened. So, again, I think we should appreciate that for all of the troubles and difficulties, for all of the prejudice and even racism of those days, there was also a high-mindedness and a liberality as well, a decency, which we shouldn't forget. So what happened at Mile Creek was that a group of about a dozen stockmen slaughtered in cold blood an encampment of Aboriginal people, and there was no obvious provocation. There hadn't been any particular outbreaks sheep killing or stockman killing or anything like that. It appeared to be a completely cold-blooded massacre. When news of this spread, Plunkett, the Irish Catholic Attorney General of New South Wales, and it's worth noting that he was appointed Attorney General here at a time when there were still legal disabilities on Catholics in Britain, he was determined to investigate. And when the jury at the first trial refused to convict, we don't know whether this is fact or legend, but one of the jurors supposedly said in the pub afterwards that the perpetrators were as guilty as hell, but they weren't going to hang whites for the murder of blacks. Plunkett was determined one way or another that this crime was not going to go unpunished. So he brought new charges against a slightly reduced group of the perpetrators, persuaded one or two of the perpetrators to turn Queen's evidence. And
that means to snitch on the others.
Yeah, to snitch on the others. And the second judge at the second trial gave a very emotional summing up to the jury, where he said that this crime cries out to heaven for justice. And the jury did convict, and seven of the perpetrators were shortly thereafter hanged. Now, this is a tribute to the fact that at least some of the judges were men of great decency, that really did believe in equality before the law. And Plunkett himself was, in his own way, a crusader for justice and decency. Some years later, there was another atrocious episode up near Grafton, present-day Grafton, where a squatter called Coots was almost certainly guilty of poisoning flour, and some 20 Aboriginal people were killed as a result of this. Again, Plunkett brought the alleged perpetrator to trial. On this occasion, however, because the only eyewitnesses were who could testify were Aboriginal people, and Aboriginal people at that time, not being Christian, were thought incapable of swearing on a Bible and therefore giving testimony on court, this guy, Coots, got off. And at the time, Plunkett tried to get the law changed to allow Aboriginal testimony and failed 10-9 in the Legislative Council. But this is another episode in which Plunkett, against the general sense of the times, was prepared to try to do justice in favour of Aboriginal people.
Mm.
I think Plunkett is one of the unsung heroes of our history. And if I can, in my own small way, do something to remind people of some of the great men and women of our past, well, let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, and the book does do that. And what I like about it and appreciate about it is that it paints a picture of all of the greys and the nuances that were going on at the time, where instead of it being a black and white picture of, a bloodthirsty imperial power coming in and willfully committing genocide, it's about the personalities who were clashing in their different interpretations of what the whole Australian project was. So you had people who were bloodthirsty racists, and you also had people who regarded themselves as being enlightened sort of, custodians of Western civilization who were trying to create a great country and to treat the natives as they saw them as compassionately as possible.
Exactly right. And even someone who probably did verge on the bloodthirsty, someone like John Batman. Now, Batman is one of the founders of Melbourne, Victoria. His father, an emancipated convict, ran a school for Aboriginal boys in Parramatta. So John Batman grew up very familiar with Aboriginal people. He then went to Tasmania and was a squatter in the Tasmanian hinterland, and he was very much part of the Black Line and all of the troubles of Tasmania in the 1820s before going across the Bass Strait to Melbourne in the 1830s.
The troubles for non-Australians, meaning the brutal annihilation of Indigenous populations in Tasmania.
Correct. I mean, there was a... It was the nearest thing to a war that we had, and there were very brutal incidents. I mean, it was the most successful Aboriginal resistance, but it also involved a lot of brutality on the other side. Anyway, Batman was, he says in his own diaries at one stage that he took some Aboriginal prisoners, and because the prisoners were unable to walk, he shot them in cold blood. But at the same time, he was someone who took Aboriginal orphans into his own household and raised them as his own. So he was obviously a man of his time, a man capable of great brutality, but also someone who was capable of at least some elements of the kindness, or at least what passed for kindness in those days.
So this history of a kind of a complicated clash between what at the time was the most advanced technological empire the world had ever known, and what was, the most traditional civilization on the planet, and the difficulty of that clash. What do you think has happened to us culturally and in terms of our pedagogy, that if you asked my 8-year-old twins what Australian history is, I mean, 8 might be a bit young, but it would probably apply also to 15-year-olds and 20-year-olds. It would be a story that we are on stolen land, which was and always will be Aboriginal land, and that mean white people came in from abroad and took it, and we're still awaiting the proper reckoning for that crime.
Exactly right. I think that is the general view which is being imparted to young Australians today. And the problem with that view is that it gives people a sense of fundamental illegitimacy. I mean, any country which is founded on something which is supposed to be a genocidal crime is a country that can never feel really comfortable with itself. And I think that that does pose enormous difficulties, particularly because I just don't think that's a fair version of our past. I mean, yes, we have to accept that the arrival of the British in 1788 and the subsequent settlement of our country was at least in the first instance a complete disruption and overthrow of the Aboriginal way of life. I mean, a largely nomadic existence was simply incompatible with the kind of pastoral expansion and settlement which was inevitable once the British arrived. And yet, even at the time of the expansion, the initial pastoral expansion, sure, there was the bloodshed, but at the same time, most of the explorers were relying on Aboriginal guides to explain to them the country that was new to British eyes, wasn't new to the Aboriginal eyes, and most of the squatters relied on Aboriginal stockmen. Aboriginal women would work in the stations and so on. So even at the very beginning, it was a story of cooperation as well as conflict.
What's happened?
Well, I think in our eagerness to redress the balance, very understandable, given that it was very much the three cheers for Australia history up until about the 1960s, in our eagerness to redress the balance, I think we've let the pendulum swing too far. And while rightly dwelling on the downside, we've forgotten the upside. In particular, we've forgotten the fact that at the official level always, and at the level of the citizenry often, there was this great goodwill. And at least an attempt, however sometimes paternalistic and misguided, to do the right thing. So what I try to do in the book is to tell both sides of the story as fairly as I can.
You talk about there being three pillars to Australia. One is the First Nations history. The other two are
British Foundation and immigrant character. And now you could say that, I suppose, about the United States as well. But I guess there were two more fundamental things about the United States: A, the War of Independence, and B, the Civil War. And there is no doubt that a bloody conflict does tend to stick in the cultural memory of people more than a kind of a gradual evolution, which is what we had.
Yeah, and the legacy of institutionalized slavery in the States, I think, is a one part of their big part of their jigsaw puzzle that we don't have.
Exactly, but I think if we appreciate that modern Australia has an Indigenous heritage, a British foundation, an immigrant character, all of us can agree that this is, in fact, correct. I think if we can all say, yes, there are these three elements, however much weight we might choose to place on any one of the three. I mean, if I'm a recent migrant, I might want to stress the immigrant character. If I'm an Aboriginal person, obviously, I will want to be very celebrating of the Indigenous heritage. And if I'm a traditional conservative like myself, I might want to put a lot of stress on the on the British Foundation. But the truth is, these are all undeniably part of us. They all undeniably have an ongoing impact, given that the institutions that shape us today are still very much the ones that were derived from Britain and developed and, I would say, improved by and large in this country. So, again, if I was asked for, if I was asked what's my purpose, I mean, my purpose is, broadly speaking, without glossing over the downside, to help Australians to feel okay about themselves by telling what I believe to be a balanced and objective story in which there is much to feel great satisfaction.
Yeah, and I mean, it strikes me, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're also trying to redress what you regard as an imbalance between our focus on those three things, that the Indigenous heritage and the multicultural immigrant, character of the country have over the past generation been valorized in
correct.
A way that the Anglo institutions
has been
have
downplayed.
Not been or have been overly downplayed, maybe. So we've sort of talked about the Indigenous heritage and some misconceptions that you think exist there. Let's just talk about that Anglo heritage. You talk about an Anglo-American ascendancy that has basically been the thrust of Australia's, I suppose, coattailing upon our two more powerful neighbours. Do you just want to give us a sense of how that shapes Australia and the West, the Anglo-American ascendancy?
Well, plainly, the late 1700s, notwithstanding the revolt of the American colonies, was the time when Britain was approaching its zenith as a country in terms of its scientific excellence, the Industrial Revolution, in terms of its military strength. It was about to defeat the greatest continental power of the time, namely Napoleonic France. So Britain was very much in the ascendancy in those days, and I guess that ascendancy continued throughout the 19th century, and then in the first half of the 20th century, I guess Britain gradually ceded its dominance to the United States. And arguably, this is one of the very few times in history when one hegemonic power handed things peacefully to another hegemonic power without a horrible war. Because in the end, I guess what both Britain and America had was more in common than opposed. I mean, they both had these strong concepts of the rule of law, strong concepts of representative and responsible government, and I guess the English language, the literary inheritance, and all the rest of it in common. And look, I think there's absolutely no doubt that the modern world has been made in English. I don't want to deprecate the heritage of Greece and Rome. I don't want to deprecate the wonderful things that I guess Cynic and other civilizations have contributed. But if you look at the modern world, English is, if you like, the world's common language. Our global dialogue tends to be very much in terms of the sorts of things that we would talk about in London or New York. And I think one of the reasons why at the moment the West's challenges are so determined to upend that global order is precisely because they feel that it has, in a sense, culturally predominated for too long. I think they perhaps understandably resent that, even though I think that the modern world produced by that long Anglo-American ascendancy, if you look at it objectively, the world at the beginning of 2020 was more free, more fair, more safe, and more rich for more people than at any time in human history.
And what role does Christianity, in your view, play in that?
Well, I think it plays a very important role because Western civilization is unimaginable without Christianity. Now, that doesn't mean that every Westerner has to be a Christian, and plainly these days many of us are not. But I think it's hard not to be, whether consciously or subconsciously, a cultural Christian if you are a part of the West, given that until relatively recently there was, if you like, an institutionalized Christianity, an explicit Christianity to most of us. And even now, our democratic ideals are based on this fundamental intuition that all are equal in the eyes of God, and our systems of justice are based on this fundamental intuition that we should treat others as we would have them treat us. And again, these are very much gospel intuitions.
Is it another component of your Christianity that I suppose the secular individualism of Western civilization, in other words, the idea that human beings shouldn't be used as a means to a greater end, that an atheistic sort of hard-nosed utilitarianism can trample people's rights in a way that a Christian ethic would not?
Correct. I mean, in the end, people have value and deserve to be respected, regardless of whether they're useful or not. I mean, my mum, God bless her, has just passed away at the age of 92. And a lot of people would say, when you're not really capable of looking after yourself, when there's not really much that you can do, that your life has no meaning. Well, I think that's dangerous, because I think it can lead to some inhumane behaviour. But B, I think it's wrong. I mean, you know, I think that there was beauty and purpose and meaning in Mum's last days.
I'm sorry to hear you just lost your mum. I lost my dad this year as well. It's a weird thing to go through. What was that experience like?
Well, I mean, I guess all of us expect to lose our parents at some point. The natural order of things is that the parents go first. So I guess we're, in a sense, accepting intellectually of it, but that doesn't mean that it's not a wrench when it happens.
Mm.
And I was always, as a youngster, for understandable reasons, I guess, closer to my dad than to my mum. And I put my dad up on a huge pedestal. He's a wonderful man, my father. I mean, Dad's great insight, which I imbibed early and have very imperfectly practiced, is that if you look hard enough, you can find quality in almost everyone, And if you want to like people and it helps to get on with them, if you like them, you just need to look hard, discern that quality and focus on that, as opposed to focusing on things that aren't so appealing, which is what most of us tend to do most of the time. Instead of looking at the good in someone, we look at the at that which we don't like and fixate on that. Anyway, so my dad was a very important part of my life. And then I guess after he died about 8 years ago, obviously I had, I suppose, duties and responsibilities towards mum. And I think one of the lovely things about her last days is that I think there was a kind of a reconciliation between her and people close to her.
Had you been estranged?
No. I'm just talking more generally.
Yeah, right. And was she still lucid until the end?
Yeah, she was. She started to get very vague in the last fortnight or so, and then she started to get a bit disoriented, I think would be the kindest way of saying it, in the last week or so.
Well, that's pretty good. I mean, making it up to the last few weeks. Yeah, my dad had Alzheimer's, so the final couple of years were not pretty. And I mean, she must have been proud of you.
Well, I think she probably was, but I was proud of her.
In terms of Christianity, religion, patriotism, national pride, and these narratives of national sort of self-recrimination and the black armband view, mm-hmm. we're seeing a rise throughout a lot of the world of a more populist, bombastic version of right-wing politics.
Yeah.
The rise of Christian nationalism in the United States, mm-hmm. Charlie Kirk's assassination, sort of the current, I suppose, hand-wringing on the right in the United States about certain people's associations with white nationalists or anti-Semites or white supremacists, almost a clamoring for some sort of national juice and meaning. Mm-hmm. What's going on there, and is there a way to course correct?
Well, I think all of us want to feel a degree of pride in that which has shaped us, whether it's our family, whether it's our community, whether it's our country, whether it's our religion, if we have a religion. And I think that in the Anglosphere in particular, over the last generation or so, there's been too much self-flagellation about a lot of that, the patriarchy, sexism, racism, all this kind of stuff. And again, it is undeniable that at times past we have been too oblivious to these things. But I think we should give ourselves credit for at least having it within ourselves to see our flaws and to do our best to correct them. I mean, I've always thought, Josh, that one of the reasons why Western civilization could flourish indefinitely in the way that other civilizations have tended to rise and fall is because more than any other civilization, I would say, we've had this self-critical capacity. We look at ourselves and say, no, we can do better than this. And we look at others and we say, well, actually, we can learn from them in this respect and that respect. But I think in just the last couple of decades, to some extent at least, it's metastasized. The self-critical faculty has metastasized into almost a self-loathing facility. And it expresses itself in this imagination that there's nothing much that's good. There's almost nothing that we can do right. And I think that's a real problem.
And you see the populist right as a backlash against that negativity.
I think so. I mean, it's said that amongst 20-something, late teens and 20-something young men today, there is a real reaction to this kind of toxic masculinity thing that has become prevalent. And look, if I was a 18-year-old bloke who'd been constantly taught by tough-minded feminist teachers, and I'd been put in my place maybe once or twice too often, I might be inclined to say, well, actually, I am not a bad person and my fellow males are not bad. We might sometimes do bad things, but that's because we're human. Everyone sometimes is less than his or her best self. But this idea that blokes have to be, as it were, retrained, reprogrammed, so that they aren't kind of energetic, aren't occasionally forthright, maybe even aggressive, because some situations require a bit of aggression. I mean, if you are confronted on the street with some act of violence, it might be desirable for you to respond with a bit of force. And so I think there is this reaction. The important thing is for the reaction to be a constructive one, not a destructive one. And I know Nigel Farage quite well, and I can fully understand why a lot of lifelong conservative voters in Britain were very disappointed and felt quite betrayed by the previous conservative government there and are now tempted to vote reform. And certainly if the opinion polls were to be translated into an election result, you would get a reform government most likely in Britain. Certainly reform would sweep away the Conservative Party as the party of the right. My anxiety about all of that is that it's much easier to criticise than to create. It's much easier to tear down than to build. And the people making very valid criticisms of the previous Conservative government might turn out to be even worse at governing themselves, because if there were, for argument's sake, to be a reform majority in the British Parliament after the next election, almost none of them would have been MPs before. None of them would have been ministers in the government before. Almost none of them would have had the experience that an elected and accountable minister has of having to work through civil servants. And plainly one of the problems, particularly in Britain, but also to some extent in Australia and America, is that governance has been more and more devolved from the elected and the accountable politicians to the unelected and the unaccountable bureaucracy. And fixing that is going to require not just a level of strength and confidence, but also a level of sophistication. And people who are new to the parliament might not have insufficient depth and insufficient numbers, the kind of sophistication that is needed to improve what I accept is, in some respects, a broken system.
And what exactly is broken about the system? Because the centre-left critique of a person like Farage or of President Trump would be they're finding scapegoats in all the wrong places. There are complicated issues here. There's the decline of manufacturing. There's chronic underinvestment in the National Health Service in the UK. There's the bungling of immigration. And there's a whole bunch of things. And here are some, as you say, people who are more inclined to break things or criticise than they are to build them themselves. So the liability is not merely a lack of experience among incoming MPs or an incoming Prime Minister. The problem is a fundamentally simplistic allocation of blame towards, I don't know, there are too many Pakistanis in Liverpool who don't speak English and we need to clamp down on them, or in the case of America, we need to send our ICE agents into to Home Depot and grab some Mexican-looking people and hustle them away with guys wearing black balaclavas and maybe put them in a South American gulag, that's not actually going to address the decline of manufacturing in Appalachia, the rise of robotics, all of the things that are actually hollowing out the middle class in those places.
But again, this is where we need to have our best people in our public life, and we need to have our best people having what are essentially civil conversations with each other. Now, that doesn't mean that they've always got to agree. And part of the critique, I think part of the valid critique of the Farages and the Trumps is that the established political parties were kind of, I think they call it the uni party. I mean, I sometimes thought that my successors as Prime Minister, coalition Prime Minister, were inclined to be a bit too Labor light, if you like. And certainly there are a lot of people who thought that the recent Conservative government in Britain was almost indistinguishable from the Blair government, for argument's sake. I happen to think that the Blair government was a pretty good Labor government. Certainly on foreign policy, I thought Blair was remarkably courageous. But nevertheless, I mean, John Howard often used to say, and he was sometimes mocked for it, he often used to say, we need to remember that the things that unite us should always be more important than anything that divides us. Now, we can quite properly divide on things like should the states rather than the Commonwealth do this or that, or should government rather than the private sector do this or that, or should youngsters be encouraged to go to university or get a trade? Do we need some form of national service to encourage a spirit of patriotism? I mean, there are all sorts of things upon which we can and should divide, but I think we should, A, try to be patriots in the sense that we love our country and want it to be its best self, and we should do our best to appreciate that even those we disagree with are normally people of good faith who want the best, even if we happen to disagree about what they think is the best. And
I mean, that's a tricky narrative to spin in a world of social media and sound bites where people are just picking the worst possible example of each other.
Correct. And this is where John Howard, Bob Hawke, our two best recent prime ministers, were probably lucky that they didn't have to live in the world of social media, which is an echo chamber for passion, often very destructive as opposed to constructive passion. I certainly think that the task of governance is getting harder all the time, and this is why it's more important than ever that our best people don't be put off, and that once they're there, our best people try as best they can to accept that the other side are not bad, just wrong on some policy issues.
And some of their own side are probably wrong on some policy issues as well. So thinking about immigration as the third sort of tranche of the Australian experience after talking about the Indigenous heritage and then the Anglo institutions, you're known for famously turning back the boats and assisting in the implementation of this quite hard-line policy towards illegal immigration, which we've seen cause so many problems in the United States and in the UK. How did that come about, and just explain to non-Australians what that process was?
Well, I was a staffer for John Hewson back in the days of the Hawke-Keating government, and we did have a boat people problem then, which was largely brought under control by John Howard in the aftermath of the Tampa situation.
This was in the 90s and early 2000s.
Yeah. And I very much formed the view back then in my staffer days that a country which loses control of its borders ultimately loses its sovereignty. Now, we never lost control of our borders to anything like the extent that the US did across the Rio Grande and Britain has across the Channel, because it is actually harder to come to Australia other than across the Torres Strait from PNG. And for all sorts of reasons, that hasn't become a problem. So look, I think it is absolutely critical that countries maintain absolute control of their borders. And what I did as Prime Minister was build on the three Howard elements, which were temporary protection visas for those who did get to Australia, offshore processing for those who we had to pick up at sea, and where possible, boat turnarounds so that they never really came into our control. The difficulty which arose in the Rudd-Gillard era was that the...
These are your predecessors.
Yeah, my predecessors on the other side of the fence, was that the people smugglers developed this tactic of scuttling their boats when our ships hove into view, which meant we had to pick them up. And of course, in the Rudd-Gillard era, they came to Christmas Island. They were then kind of enveloped in the kind of activist lawyer ecosystem.
Because that's an Australian territory, so they're into our refugee system.
Exactly right. So they can get sort of social justice lawyers, go before various tribunals, appeal their way through the system, and 10 or 15 years later, they're still here. I mean, you wouldn't believe the number of Uber drivers who, when they've worked out who I am, Josh, have told me the story of how they came by boat sometime between 2008 and 2013, and could I please sort out their citizenship status? Anyway.
You're like, you know what I did to boat arrivals, right, mate?
Anyway, so what I did as Prime Minister, assisted by Scott Morrison and Peter Dutton, was when they scuttled their boats and we had to take them on board, instead of taking them to Christmas Island, because the game was up essentially once they got to Christmas Island, instead of taking them there, we would hold them on a mothership where they could not communicate with their activist lawyer friends. They didn't have their mobile phones, etc. And then on a suitable night, we'd put them in a big orange life raft and send them back to Java. And I knew one morning early in 2014 that we had got on top of this when the front page of the Daily Telegraph was a full-page photograph of a big orange life raft washed up on a beach in Java. And I thought, this is going to go through all of the would-be boat people, would-be illegal migrant networks, and they will figure out that giving 10 grand to a people smuggler is just a return ticket back to Java. And the boat stopped then. And for the next 10 years, we didn't have any. And to the credit of the Albanese government, it's largely maintained that policy architecture. We've had a few boats under Anthony Albanese, but the would-be illegal migrants have all been swiftly repatriated, as they should.
I mean,
so it's worked for us. Britain has completely failed to get on top of this. Completely failed to get on top of this.
Why is that? Why are their boats going across the channel? I mean, you would have thought that France was an even better collaborator than Indonesia has been. Why can't they just tell the French not to let them take off from Calais?
Because, to be honest, two things. A, if they're in France, they're a problem for the French. If they're in Britain, they're no longer a French problem. And second, the French have been punishing the British for Brexit. Now, I think that the British government, both under the Conservatives and now under Labour, has been altogether too timid in the way it's responded. For instance, a little bit of informal action on the beaches of northern France, where patriotic Britons literally put a knife into these rubber duckies before they take off. A little bit of MI6 action to break up some of these people smuggling gangs in France, I think, is absolutely called for. And I can't understand why the British government has been so diffident about all of this. I suppose they're conscious of not wanting to upset the EU. But part of the problem with Britain for decades now has been this defeatism and declinism in the British establishment, and this unduly deferential attitude towards the Europeans, which Churchill, Thatcher, to some extent Blair, and to some extent Johnson stood up against, but which I'm afraid far too many people in the British establishment have succumbed to.
I mean, if you were a member of a political party that was about to get completely annihilated by an upstart party like Reform, largely on the basis of illegal immigration and concerns in the UK about demographic change and the assimilation of particularly Muslim communities there, and there were significant numbers of people getting onto boats and coming across the channel, and you've got a pretty formidable navy, I don't quite understand why you don't just station the navy off Calais. And I mean, you don't shoot them, but like there are water cannons, there are, you know, naval. I'm sure, I'm not a military expert. You know more than I do. I'm sure you could come up with a plan.
Completely correct. Completely correct. But there's this, I suppose, fastidiousness, if you like, this scrupulosity, if you like, which has essentially prevented the British government, whether it be the former Conservative government or the current Labour government, from doing that kind of thing. Do not underestimate the human rights lawyer lobby inside the political establishment, both on the left, but also to some extent on the right. For instance, eventually the Conservative government came up with the Rwanda plan, which was a bit like the Howard government's Nauru solution.
But, and just for foreign listeners, basically this is another component of, this is the second component that you said of Australia's immigration policy, which
if
is...
If people come illegally by boat, they get transferred to a third
different country, either Papua
where
New Guinea.
Where they will be safe, but they will be outside the jurisdiction.
Well, you say they'll be safe.
Courts.
I mean, that's the other big criticism of your administration and of this policy, right? That that Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and that Nauru were places where human rights abuses basically were happening, that they were horrible places.
I don't think that's not fair.
No?
I mean...
It was no picnic.
I don't say that...
Called like, you know, desert island concentration.
I don't say that living... Living rough in Port Moresby is a particularly great way to live, but the Manus Island camp was run by, well, there was a strong Australian element in its running. People were fed, they were clothed, they were housed, they were safe. Ditto in Nauru, which is actually not a bad place. I mean, it might not quite be, you know, Hamilton Island, but it's it's a pretty lovely place, Nauru.
Right, but they were in detention.
In Nauru, they had the run of the island, essentially. They would go back at night to the camp. But in Nauru, and I'm talking now about the Howard
yes.
government, because we didn't need Nauru in my time.
Because you were handing them boats.
Yeah, we were on top of the problem. There were no boats. But in Nauru, yeah, they had the run of the island. I'm not quite so sure what the arrangements were in Manus, but to get back to the essential point, when you've got a serious problem of illegal migration by boat, it's run by criminal gangs, and that's bad, and it inevitably involves a lot of drownings at sea. I mean, we think that 1,000-plus people died at sea in the Rudd-Gillard era. Plainly, dozens of people are dying in the English Channel every month. And the only way to actually be safe is to stop this illegal migration by boat. So it has to be stamped out. It absolutely has to be stamped out. No self-respecting government can do it. But when the British government tried to escalate its response through sending arrivals to Rwanda, there was an immediate application to the courts, and I'm not totally au fait with exactly the mechanics of this, but the deportation of people to Rwanda was stopped because of Britain's adherence to the European Convention on Human Rights, the ECHR. Now, to me, the obvious solution to this is just to abrogate the ECHR, at least insofar as it applies to illegal migration by boat in your country. Parliament could have done that. And given the majority that the Conservatives had, they could have passed it through the House of Commons in a day had they wanted to. But
I mean, in terms of public opinion, it probably doesn't help that Rwanda, you know, the Howard government probably had the benefit of the fact that no one had ever heard of bloody Nauru. So they didn't know. Rwanda doesn't sound like a good look, does it?
Except that. But Rwanda, at least over the last couple of decades, has been a peaceful, even quite a prosperous by African standards country. The other thing the British government could have done, they could have, just as part of the Howard government's response back in the late 90s was Christmas Island, the British government could have opened camps in, say, Ascension Island or Reunion or somewhere, one of the British, one of the very remote British overseas territories. So there are all sorts of things that the British government could and should have done, up to and including direct action on the beaches of France and very assertive actions in the English Channel. There are all sorts of things that could have been done. But there was, as I said, this scrupulosity on the part of the kind of human rights lobby inside both parties.
Now, I mean,
Chris, Sir Keir Starmer is essentially a human rights lawyer. The Attorney General in the British Labour government is apparently a very noted and outspoken human rights lawyer. I often used to say that moral theologians did not make good statesmen, and similarly, I think human rights lawyers do not make good national leaders.
I mean, you are a moral theologian.
I studied for the priesthood for a couple of years, I was a dropout.
You're a failed moral theologian. I mean, so let's grant that the leader of a country has a responsibility to secure that nation's borders, but let's talk about the moral, the morality of it, and the theology of it, if you want, because you are a religious person. So the detention centres, you know, okay. Let's, at the risk of being too dismissive of human rights law here, there was a 23-year-old asylum seeker, Reza Barati, who was killed on Manus when you were PM.
Right.
In 2014, when you were PM, The Guardian and SBS reported that asylum seekers on Nauru had stitched their lips shut as part of a mass hunger strike in protest of what they called catastrophic conditions, including children with their lips sewn shut.
Well, we didn't do that. They did that to themselves.
Yeah, they did that to themselves as a result of the conditions that we'd put them in. In 2015, the same thing happened on Manus Island. ABC News reported that 15 people have sewn their lips together and 400 men are on a hunger strike. And in 2014, your government passed the National Security Legislation Amendment Act, which threatened journalists and doctors and detention centre staffers and teachers and whistleblowers with 10 years in prison if they reported on what was happening in the offshore detention centres. I'm just interested in the theology of this, because we were saying earlier about how the sort of Christian ethic is that people can't be used for a purpose beyond themselves, that they have an intrinsic dignity, right? That's fundamental to your worldview.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the cynic would say, yeah, you can talk about all of the people who aren't dying at sea as a result of these people's hardship, but we're still using these people who are in our duty of care in certainly unseemly ways, aren't we?
Josh, they were always being fed, they were always being clothed, they were always being housed, and there was no violence being committed against them by us or by the people of Nauru and PNG.
Well, I mean, we were jailing them indefinitely with no trial.
We were detaining them. They could always volunteer to leave. I know there were some complications with countries that wouldn't take back people who'd left and had destroyed passports and things like that. But there were always other things that could have been done. And I don't believe that a national government should be morally intimidated by the bad behaviour of other people that we have in no way forced upon them. I mean, no one is forced to sew his or her lips together. If someone threatens to commit suicide, and I have never mistreated the person who is threatening to commit suicide and demanding something of me, is that my fault?
But it's the if I have never mistreated.
Honestly, these people never had a right to come. See, this is the other thing, Josh. No one who has travelled through several safe countries can claim to be a refugee or can claim asylum. If you're fair dinkum, let's suppose you're a persecuted Afghan and you come through Pakistan and then you fly to Malaysia and then you get to Indonesia, you have come through three countries where, okay, you might not get social security, you might not find it easy to get a job, but you are physically safe. And to be a refugee, you have to have a well-found fear of persecution. By the time you have gone through a safe country, you are no longer a refugee. You are a would-be illegal migrant. In other words, you have no right to rock up on our doorstep or to attempt to enter our country. You just don't have a right. And if people are attempting to do something that they have no right to do, they are violating your country. Just as if someone smashes down your door and enters your house, they are violating your household. They are morally and legally in the wrong. And
if there's a desperate person, Tony, who bashes down your door because they're, you know,
a desperate person will knock on the door.
Let's suppose they're not kind enough to do that.
They've got a problem.
Right. But is there a limit to what you can then do to them? Once they're in your duty of care, doesn't the Christian in you think that you have a duty of care to their well-being?
You have a duty to do what you can to alleviate the circumstances that might have led to that problem. But once they take the law into their own hands and violate what is your sacred space, you don't have to put up with that for a second. You really don't. And so, but let's, if we may, Josh, move a little on from the whole question of illegal migration, because there's a bigger problem, and it's virtually out of control legal migration at the moment. Certainly in Britain and in Australia, we have very large, by historical standards, waves of migration. And the difficulty with migration at the levels and from the sources that we've currently got is that it is pretty obviously in Britain, and to some extent even here in Australia, I think, challenging social cohesion. I mean, I thought one of the most terrible things that I can remember was that demonstration on October the 9th, 2023, outside the Opera House, where we all heard what we thought was "gas the Jews," and we certainly heard "F the Jews" and all the rest of it.
Even if it was "Where are the Jews," which is what their defenders say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not dreadful. Crazy it's about an, a bunch of anti-Semites gathering
it's
together.
It's an intimidatory, it's a
yelling,
deeply
"Where are the Jews?"
intimidatory situation. Now, I know that there were lots of people who were native-born Australians in these demonstrations, but there have also been a large presence of recent migrants in these demonstrations, and we certainly have people in mosques and prayer houses in Sydney and Melbourne preaching deeply inflammatory sermons, which I think are un-Australian. They have no place in Australia. If we take seriously the citizenship pledge from this time forward, under God or not, as the case may be, I pledge my allegiance to Australia and its people, whose democratic beliefs I share, whose rights and liberties I respect, and whose laws I will uphold and obey. I mean, if those people have taken the citizenship pledge and meant it, they aren't really living it. And I think there is a problem. I mean, if you compare post-war migration to Australia and much of the migration to the United States, there was very much this emphasis on integration from day one and assimilation as quickly as possible. My way of describing it is from day one, you've got to be part of Team Australia. And I think far too many recent migrants are encouraged by officialdom, if you like, by the general zeitgeist of these times, to live in Hotel Australia as opposed to joining Team Australia. And because the numbers are much larger in Britain, and because this whole enclave thing seems to have developed more in Britain, it's worse there than it is in Australia.
Well, they also don't have a point system the way we do, do they? So don't they get more, I don't want to say a more undesirable caliber of migrant, but aren't we better at picking and choosing than their sort of family relationship? You know, my great aunt can come over because I'm in the UK or whatever.
I think that we get credit, which we don't always deserve here. We like to tell others and tell ourselves that we have a rigorous skills-based immigration system. But if you look at the figure that counts, net overseas migration, the figure that's been running at close to 500,000 for the last 3 years, by far the biggest component of that is people coming for education. Now, the theory is they're coming for education. The reality is that most of them are coming for residency and or work. And our problem is that to press down on that, we've got to press down on the universities and the other educational providers. So we have created a vested interest which wants to perpetuate the problem. As well, in that net overseas migration figure, there's many tens of thousands of short-term workers who are coming in to do jobs which supposedly can't be filled by Australians. I mean, for instance, if you go to a hotel or a nursing home, if you get a food delivery or jump in a taxi, almost certainly the person who is cleaning your room, helping do all the things that you need, driving you around, delivering your food, is going to be a recent migrant. Now, I'm not being critical of those people for a second, because they are doing necessary jobs, and quite understandably, they want a better life for themselves. And they've made the decision, because no one is forced to come to Australia, they've made the decision that life for them in Australia, even doing a menial entry-level job, is better than wherever it was they've come from. So I'm not at all critical of them, but I am critical of successive governments which haven't done enough to ensure that Australians take the jobs that are available, don't go on social security, take jobs that are available. And if we genuinely can't get Australians to do certain jobs, either we need to improve the training, we need to pay them more.
Right.
Simple as that. I really dislike this notion that if I can't get an Australian to work for $30 an hour in a nursing home, I've got to bring in people from the Philippines or from Nepal.
I mean, it reminds me of the same conversation they have in the States, where they say, we couldn't do anything serious about illegal immigration because who would pick our oranges? And I was just thinking, well, maybe your orange juice has to be a bit more expensive so that Americans will do it.
Exactly right, because at the end of the day, we do ourselves no favours, and we indeed do our recent migrants no favours if we fundamentally change the character of the country. Every single migrant comes to Australia because he or she perceives, however dimly, that there is a better life for them in Australia. Not Australia as it might be, but Australia as it is. This is why I think we should preserve the core Anglo-Celtic culture of our country, and we should certainly preserve the core Judeo-Christian ethos of our country, because that has always been central to our identity. It's always been central to our appeal to migrants, and I think we owe it to ourselves and to our descendants to maintain it.
I mean, I do suspect that one reason why we enjoy better multicultural social cohesion than the UK and the US do is because of our strong border policies, in the sense that, you know, as Caldwell, the first immigration minister, had the insight in Australia that as long as people feel like the borders are under control, they will tolerate much higher levels of immigration than if they feel like it's chaotic. Before we leave just illegal immigration.
If people think the government is under control, they will be understanding because they think they, in the end, can control the government.
Exactly.
If people think that no one is in control, or if people smugglers are in control, well, that's a huge problem.
Yeah. And so, I mean, when you do get to the sort of the end of your life and you're thinking about, you know, a life well lived, I am just interested, like, in terms of your Christianity, will you feel like, with regard to the Medivac thing and, like, whether or not, you know, people could come off those detention centres to get medical care in Australia, will you have an easy and relaxed and comfortable soul, or will you wonder whether there was a more genteel way of achieving the same ends?
I have never been morally troubled by the things that I did in public life, the positions that I've adopted in public life. I don't for a second, Josh, claim to be a person without flaw or blemish, but nevertheless, no, I'm not morally troubled. I mean, you know, the terror bombing of German cities during the Second World War was deeply morally troubling, probably even more so than the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because I don't think anyone thought that was going to end the war, whereas arguably the atomic weapons were going to end the war, because they would just intimidate the Japanese out of continuing to resist. But no, I'm not morally troubled by any of the actions of the Abbott government, or indeed the Howard government, or the public positions that I've taken.
One of the things that the conservative side of politics is grappling with at the moment is net zero and carbon and, you know, climate chaos and everything. And we don't have to go over a whole bunch of nuanced sort of party details, which will bore everybody to death, nor do we have to give any credence to the most extreme climate activist vision of doom, which I sort of share some of your exhaustion. I get the sense that there is so much negativity among my peers that between Gaza and climate chaos, you know, we're just entering a 21st century that is going to be aflame and burning. And but it is worth just wondering, the criticism that I hear the most reasonable energy and electricity and climate people level at Australia is that the lack of certainty that we've had over the past 10 or 15 years on climate has made the energy sector jittery, and that there's been an underinvestment in energy. And one reason why electricity prices are as high as they are is because we've sort of kicked the can down the road, and every CEO of a big energy company knows that at some point we're going to have to do something about carbon. We're either going to join an emissions trading scheme, or we're going to have a carbon tax of some kind. Is it conceivable that the past 10 or 15 years would have been more stable for energy in Australia if the Turnbull-Rudd emissions trading scheme had existed since 2009?
Josh, the so-called trilemma, reliability, affordability, and sustainability, I'm afraid we can't have all three, not in Australia, given that we don't have mass hydropower and we won't do nuclear.
We could do nuclear.
Well, we should do nuclear.
I'm with you on that.
The trouble is, even if we started today, we wouldn't get nuclear for 5 to 10 years. So in the short term, we've got to have, I think, what we need most, and you know, sustainability, affordability, reliability. The thing that is least important, frankly, is sustainability. I mean, reliability and affordability are the absolute essentials. So I think that, I mean, if I were asked what's your energy policy, Abbott, my energy policy today would be no more coal-fired power stations to close, get gas out of the ground with extreme rapidity, no more subsidies for renewables, because if renewables really are cheap, we don't need subsidy, and end the nuclear ban. And what we really should be doing is refurbishing our coal-fired power stations. Because it is still the cheapest form of baseload power.
But who pays for that? Because the energy...
Ultimately, consumers pay for it.
I mean, the energy companies don't want to invest in it because they don't believe that in 30 or 40 years' time there's not going to be a price on carbon.
It's political risk. That's the problem for them is political risk. They know that coal-fired power is the cheapest form of baseload reliable power. I mean, why would China be opening two coal-fired power stations a week if this was not the case? Why would we be exporting record amounts of coal to China and other places like India if coal wasn't still the cheapest form of baseload power?
Yeah, but I mean, their worry is that it's cheap right now and we're not factoring in the negative externalities of how much climate chaos is going to cost in the long run, right? So let me grant you that let's not take the cartoon caricature of the blue head, climate hippie who is chaining themselves to a train and throwing paint on a Rembrandt or something. But the more modest scientific consensus, like what probability do you give to the possibility that climate, you know, man-made climate change, that climate chaos over the course of the 21st century will cost us trillions of dollars, make some beachside towns uninsurable, require enormous investment in infrastructure for some coastal communities, cause refugee flows due to changes in the monsoons that will put strains on liberal democracy, increase droughts and bushfires for farmers, and just generally, you know, not kill us all, but make life a lot more costly and frustrating for my kids than it would have been if the world could have gotten its act together on reducing emissions.
Well, Josh,
what's the probability there? It's not zero, is it?
I think it's very low. I honestly think it's very low. Most
scientists don't.
Well, science is determined by facts, not by consensus, if you like. I mean, I'm sure when Galileo told us the world was round, most scientists, in inverted commas, of those days said rubbish, but he was right. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but Galileo was the pioneer who was making a new prediction, scientists are. But, he wasn't a vested interest who was defending his turf.
I am not convinced at all by this statement that 97% of climate scientists think X, Y, and Z.
But that's why I'm asking the probability
at. If there's a single one who has got a very plausible counter case. Now, right,
Arnold Schwarzenegger attitude is like if you go to a bunch of doctors and a few of them say that you've got cancer and you need to treat it and a few of them say you don't just ignore it and go, well, a lot of them say that I don't have cancer. You do it anyway out of an abundance of caution because you don't want to have to incur.
Okay, but if all of the ones that were telling you had cancer were employed by a drug company that made the anti-cancer drug.
But they're not.
You might be a little bit
but
more...
But they're not, are they? They are, climate scientists they are not all employed. Getting, what are they shilling?
They are all getting research grants that largely depend upon them accepting the so-called consensus.
Well, the dissenters are often getting research grants from oil companies.
I don't know that that's entirely fair. If you can show me, Josh, the climate scientists who are getting research grants from oil companies and coal companies.
They're vanishingly small, the ones who say that there's almost a zero chance that it's going to be costly and inconvenient.
Well, I have a lot of time for Bjorn Lomberg, who accepts that mankind's carbon dioxide emissions are likely going to cause climate problems down the track. And he says that by far the best way of dealing with this is to maximize our wealth so we're best placed to adapt to whatever challenges we face down the track. And look, I accept that we've only got one planet. We have a duty to look after it. We want to give it to our kids and grandkids in at least as good shape as we found it. So I am all in favor of minimizing carbon dioxide emissions. What I find very implausible, Josh, is this idea that mankind's carbon dioxide emissions are the sole or even the main cause of any climate change that takes place. given that we know that there's been massive climate change over the eons, which have had nothing to do with mankind. I mean, I was at a conference with Boris Johnson a year or so back, and Boris and I were agreeing very much about Israel and the Middle East. We were agreeing very much about Russia and Ukraine. And then Boris got onto his climate change soapbox. I said, Boris, tell me this. If mankind's emissions are the only thing that matter, how did the ice ages happen?
But, Tony, you can have a fluctuating climate.
Yeah.
And you can also have a new cause for an acceleration of one of the peaks in that, but carbon dioxide is not new.
These
levels are. I mean, you're a smart man, Tony. If you get a goldfish bowl and you seal it up, and you put it under a heat lamp, and you put carbon dioxide into it, it gets hotter than if it didn't have carbon dioxide in it.
I accept the physics. All things being equal, an increase in carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere should raise the temperature. That's physics. I get that. But carbon dioxide is not the only factor here. There's sunspot activity. There's volcanic activity.
But this is why I ask about the probability, because it strikes me as just, like, I don't know, because I'm not a climate scientist, but it strikes me that if there's a non-zero chance that it's going to be really expensive and disruptive, then the question becomes, what do we do now and is it worth it? Like, it may be the case that for a country the size of Australia, the best policy is to pretend that we're doing a lot about climate change and then to burn as much coal as we possibly can so that other people will fix the problem for us.
Which is what China and India and places like that
are doing. Right. So it may be that we shouldn't shoot ourselves in the foot if we've got so many fossil fuels. Yeah. But I don't understand the reticence to even acknowledge the existence of a problem that is worth reckoning with.
Well, what I'm doing is expressing some skepticism about just how frightened we should be about all of this, given that whatever we do, there will still be storms, floods, fires, droughts, whatever we do, because they've been part of the world forever.
Sure, but having a really bad one every 100 years is different from having a really bad one every 10 years.
I accept that, but the richer we are, the better we will be able to deal with them, whether they come every 10 years or every 100 years. And at the moment, policy in Australia, Britain, and much of Western Europe is grievously impoverishing us. And it's not actually making any difference to global emissions, because China, India, and Russia are massively increasing, and many other countries are massively increasing their emissions in the goal of becoming economically stronger and giving their populations a better life.
So, I mean, if we just look at the cost of electricity and we don't care about climate change and we think that it's too uncertain to bother doing anything about, Treasury...
I'm not saying there is no such thing as climate change. Obviously, the climate does change.
No, and
I'm not saying we should be completely indifferent to carbon dioxide emissions. What I am saying is that our efforts to reduce carbon dioxide emissions should not be at the cost of local jobs, driving industries offshore, and imposing heavy costs on ordinary people.
Isn't,
and that's what they're doing right now.
Well, I mean, Treasury let me just put the claim to you and you can refute it. Okay. Treasury this year modelled the cost of an orderly versus a disorderly transition to, you know, net zero, on the assumption that you're probably not going to be able to convince all Australians of the position that we shouldn't do anything about it. And gas and electricity prices end up nearly twice as high if there's a lack of credible climate targets. 2 years after you left office, energy executives testified to a Senate committee about a damaging investment strike in new assets. They were saying, we're not building anything because there's a policy vacuum and there's no clear national, climate direction. Mm-hmm. The Finkel Review that year concluded that the uncertain and changing direction of emissions reduction policy for the electricity sector has compromised the investment environment in the national electricity market.
The Australian
Energy Regulator State of the Energy Market in 2018 said the same thing, investors themselves saying that the lack of stability and predictability was the cause of underinvestment.
This is because our energy system, our electricity supply, has been governed to reduce emissions rather than to produce affordable and reliable power. I mean, for the last 15 years, with the brief exception of my government, we have run our electricity supply more to reduce emissions than we have to maximise affordability and reliability. And I think we've got to drop that. I think we should say, look, reducing emissions is nice to do, but we are running our electricity system to get the lowest possible 24/7 power.
And if we did that, you believe that the energy sector would believe that the next 10 governments are also going to stand by that and therefore they can invest in
coal? Well, the alternative is to have prices going up and up and up, and to lose all of our energy-intensive industries, and I think that's wrong.
But so if the Turnbull-Rudd plan had come in and we had an emissions trading scheme, then you would have had a short-term increase in the price of carbon-based electricity, and most of the modelling was that then you'd get a medium to long-term tapering off. And a lot of the industry say, by now we'd have lower electricity prices because they would have known what Australia's policy was. Because that mainly the problem is they just don't believe that your point of view is going to win ultimately, permanently Australia.
Well, they think that climate alarmism has so taken hold that governments will succumb to the kind of climate catastrophism that you earlier suggested was widespread.
They just think that, you know, at some point Australia is going to get on the same page as most of the world.
I mean, the only
Europe has an emissions trading scheme.
Of course they do, but the Europeans have succumbed to climate catastrophe. The Europeans are taking their lead from Greta Thunberg. You know, it is a modern day version of the Piper. But it's not sensible policy. I mean, given all the other challenges we face, the cost of living challenge domestically, the geostrategic challenge from China and the other authoritarian powers, we can't be making ourselves economically weaker at this time. We've got to be making ourselves economically stronger so that we can revive industry in countries like ours. We can power the AI revolution, which is going to be vastly energy intensive. We ain't going to do it on solar panels and batteries. I'm sorry, Josh. You can run a house on solar panels and batteries, but you cannot run a first world sophisticated manufacturing economy on solar panels and batteries. You just can't do it. And the grievous error that so many people, more on the Labor side than on my side, but on both sides of politics, have been peddling this last decade and a half, is that somehow we can have energy abundance relying on wind and solar power, which is only there 30% of the time. I mean, you know, for God's sake, the intermittency thing is the fundamental flaw in renewable power, at least in wind and solar power. And Chris Bowen can tell us till the cows come home that the wind and the sun don't send you a bill. But the power companies sure do, because A, they've got to build the infrastructure to get the sun and the wind's energy. Then they've got to produce all the extra transmission lines required in a decentralized grid. Transmission lines are only being used 30% of the time on average. Then they've got to firm up all of this for all of the times when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. That is a gargantuan expense. I mean, why are our power bills going up? The power bills are going up because of this transition, not because of policy uncertainty, in inverted commas.
Pulling back to wrap up, I don't remember feeling as sort of anxious about the fate of liberal democracy, as I do at the moment, with the rise of far-right parties in Europe, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, China's saber-rattling, the fate of AUKUS in the balance, Donald Trump, you know, creating constitutional mayhem in the United States. How optimistic are you about Australia's fate and about the fate of Western civilization at the moment?
I think you're right to be concerned, Josh. I mean, I sometimes fear that we are living through the twilight of the West. Because the world would be so much worse and darker if that happens, I remain optimistic that it won't, because I think that, as Margaret Thatcher once said, the facts are conservative. And when the lights start going out, we will wake up to the climate cult nonsense. When doctors start getting sued, we will wake up to the errors of some of this gender fluidity push. When we confront a serious military challenge, we will start to realize that our society is actually worth defending. My anxiety is that things might have to get worse before they get better. That said, because what has been achieved is so precious and so, I think, self-evidently good, I do think in the end we will discover the intestinal fortitude to preserve it.
Tony Abbott, thanks for coming on Uncomfortable Conversations.
Thank you, Josh.